Okay. So thank you, and I'd like to thank all the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak today. So I hope my voice will last to the end of the talk. What I'm going to talk about is the resolution of Edge Ideals, and this is joint work with my colleague Tai Ha at Tulane University. Okay. So the nice thing about coming near the end of the conference is that a lot of these things have been seen before, but I'll go over them one more time. Okay. Let me straighten that out for you. Okay. So what I'm going to be talking about. This on the first slide here is some monomial ideals, some facts about that. So throughout the talk, R will just be a polynomial ring, and K will be a field. Okay, so you can pick your favorite field, usually just the complex numbers. It really won't matter what the field is, except in one or two cases, and I'll point out where we have to pay attention to what the field is. Okay. A monomial is just the product of these xi's. Okay, and the ai's here are just non-negative integers. And we say a monomial is square-free if the ai's are either 0 or 1. And it's quadratic if its degree is 2. Okay? So an ideal inside of this ring is a monomial ideal if it's generated by monomials. So just a quick example here, and these are really the things I'm going to be interested in. It's an ideal like this. We have x1 times x2, x1 times x3. This is a square-free because we don't have any powers higher than 2 showing up, and it's quadratic. Each of them have degree 2, and it's a monomial ideal. Okay. Now, as I just said, I'm going to be kind of looking a lot at this talk at, oh, I don't know what's happening there. Okay. Let me straighten that. Okay. Throughout the talk, I'll be looking mostly at square-free quadratic monomial ideals. Okay. Now, why this particular class? Well, I want to look at this class because we have like a nice bijection between these classes of ideals and simple graphs. Okay. Now, by simple graph, I just mean the graph has no loops or multiple edges on n vertices. So let me just give you a sense of how this bijection works. You start with your graph on your vertex set V and its edge set E. And suppose the vertices are x1 through xn. Okay, now we're going to abuse notation throughout this talk. We're going to use xi to mean both a variable and a vertex. Okay, so it means both a vertex of a graph and a variable of our ring. And what we do is any time that we have an edge in our graph, an edge between the vertex xi and xj, we put the monomial xi times xj into our ideal. Okay, and we take the ideal generated by those guys. Okay? Now these things are called the edge ideal of the graph. And these things were introduced by Villarreal in around 1990. Okay? So just a quick example. Okay, here we have a graph on 6 vertices. And its edge ideal is actually the first ideal I put up on the first slide. So, for example, I have an edge between x1 and x2, so in pops the generator x1 times x2. And you can see how this would work backwards, right? If you knew you had x3, x4, you would go and say, okay, I have to put an edge between the vertex x3 and x4. Okay. And then the polynomial ring just has the same number of variables as vertices. Okay. So kind of I would say an ongoing research program in kind of commutative algebra right now is kind of establish a dictionary between some of the algebraic invariants of this ideal look at the and how that is associated to numerical data coming from the graph, okay, like the number of edges, the degrees of its vertices, that sort of thing. Okay, and then the hope is that once you kind of build up a big enough dictionary, you can actually now then start proving graph theoretical results algebraically, or vice versa. Maybe you want to prove something algebraically using a result from graph theory. Yes. Okay, so if you want a good place to start and learn some more about this stuff, I recommend Villarreal's book from 2001 on monomial algebras. There's kind of four or five chapters on this topic. Okay. Now, in this talk, what I want to do is kind of... I should mention, it is a bit pricey, but if you're going to get into this, it's a worthwhile reference, okay? Or you could just go out and find the original sources. I think that would probably be a lot cheaper, okay? So what I want to do in this talk is now explore the minimal graded resolution of these ideals and discuss how the invariants that appear in this resolution correspond to the data described in G, okay? Now, we've seen minimal graded resolutions, okay? Through a number of talks, Shin mentioned them, and some other people have mentioned them. But you know, just because we're coming from two different areas, I thought I'd just run through what a resolution is one more time. Okay. So don't fall asleep during this little interlude here. So just a little digression. Okay, so what is a resolution of an ideal? Well, one of the ways I like to think about it is that it's encoding many of the invariants of your ideal. Okay, and what it's doing is it's describing or measuring relations among the generators of the ideal. Okay, so just some terms here. I think we're all familiar with these things. We say that a polynomial is homogeneous if all its terms have the same degree. So for example, the first guy there is homogeneous of degree 4, because each of its individual terms here, the x1 squared, x2 squared, and the x cubed to the 4th, they all have degree 4. But the other guy is not homogeneous, because the first term has degree 4, and the second guy has degree 16. And an immediate consequence of the definition is that monomials are all homogeneous, because they only have one term. Now, the polynomial ring is a graded ring. Okay, so it just means that it has this direct sum decomposition of the graded D pieces. Okay, so R sub D is just going to be the set of all homogeneous polynomials whose degree is D. Okay. Now, we'll be interested in these polynomial rings, okay, but we're actually going to be kind of interested in these polynomial rings that are shifted or twisted. Okay, so I'm not sure what the proper term, shifted or twisted. You could go either way. Okay, so what is the polynomial ring twisted by an integer? Okay, so pick a particular integer, any of your favorite integers, and we say that the ring, polynomial ring shifted by e, is really just the same ring as the polynomial ring you begin with. So it'll have the same operations of addition and subtraction. The only thing that you're doing is you're changing the degrees of everything. So in this new polynomial ring, it's not a new polynomial ring, this regraded polynomial ring, what is degree d in this ring was originally degree d plus e in the original ring. Okay, so as an example, I'm going to pick my favorite integer to be minus 4. So in this ring, the degree of 1 is actually going to be 4. Why is that? Well, 1 was originally had degree 0 in your polynomial ring, but 4 is equal to 4 minus 4, so that means it belongs to the degree 4 part of this ring twisted by minus 4. Okay? And just another example there, x1 squared plus x1 times x2 has degree 6 in this shifted ring. Okay? And what we're really interested in now are these free R modules, where you're just taking a whole bunch of these polynomial rings shifted in by various degrees. See, one way to think of it is just it's a collection of t-tuples where your fi belongs to the polynomial ring shifted by ei. Okay, and why you want to do that is because you want to have a notion of what it means for an element to be homogeneous of degree d in one of these fancy-looking new R modules here. Okay. So we just say that an element in this new R module is homogeneous of degree d if each of the individual fi's belong to the degree d part of this new the polynomial ring reshifted by the degree ei. Okay, so x1 squared plus x1 times x2 and x1 cubed plus 3 times x1 times x2 is now a homogeneous thing of degree 6. This is homogeneous in degree 6 in here, and this is homogeneous in degree 6 in that ring. Okay. So we now take an ideal inside of our polynomial ring, and we have to assume that it's a homogeneous ideal. Okay, so it just means that it's generated by homogeneous elements. And as I said, a monomial is homogeneous, so any of the monomial ideals we look at will satisfy what's going to go happen on this slide. Okay, now associated to this ideal is a minimal graded free resolution. So it just means that we have an exact sequence of maps here, where each of these FIs are R modules that look like those new things I just put up on the previous slide here. Okay, so it's just this R module where we're shifting each of them. And what's important is that we're really just taking non-negative integers, and then we're taking the negative of those. So when you're looking at all the shifts, they're all going to be negative numbers. Okay, so this is just saying that it's an exact sequence, and the length of the resolution is bounded by the number of indeterminants in your polynomial ring. Okay, so it has finite lengths. Okay, so just the kernel is just all those things that get sent to zero. Okay. So let's go back to kind of that one idea. What is a resolution doing, right? A resolution is measuring relations among the generators, right? And how is it doing that? Well, the kernel of this map is telling you relations among the generators, okay? And then this map here, the kernel of that map is going to tell you relations among the relations that belong into the kernel of the first map, okay, and so on. Let me rephrase that. I have that right here. So the kernel of the first map is describing relations among the generators of the ideal. And then the kernel of each map after that is describing the relations among the generators from the previous kernel. Okay, each of the previous kernels are R modules, R submodules of those R modules that I had up there. Okay. So what do I really need to get away from, take away from this? Okay, when you have a homogeneous ideal and you have its graded resolution, there are a lot of numbers showing up, okay, all of those twists or shifts. Okay, and we set beta ij of the ideal to be the number of times that minus j, okay, that's where the j is coming from, appears in the ith R module. Okay, so how many times does minus j show up in the ith R module? It's called the ith j's graded Betti number. Okay. So the graded Betti number beta 0j, it's just calculating the number of generators of the ideal of degree j, and beta ij of I is the number of generators of the kernel, okay, thinking of it as a R submodule of the original big thing like this, of degree j. And now by degree j here, I mean that new degree, new sense of homogeneous elements in objects like this. So that's what's important is, given an ideal, you can get a whole whack of numbers. Okay. So just to simplify things, we'll write R sub D shifted by minus E just to mean you have R minus E D times. You have D copies of it. Okay. So just a quick example. Let's go back to our original edge ideal. Okay, here's the graph. I didn't put the vertices on. Doesn't really matter. And what we have is this would be the minimal graded resolution of the ideal corresponding to that graph. Okay, so this we are familiar with reading this stuff off. For example, beta 0,2 just means go to the zero step. Okay, this is the zero step, and ask how many times does minus 2 show up? 7 times. Okay. Beta 0,18, you go to the zero step. How many times does minus 18 show up? There are no minus 18, so it's 0. And beta 2,4, 0, 1, 2. How many times does minus 4 show up? It's the 5. Okay. So what we want to do is kind of look at these numbers here. Okay. So let me just kind of refine kind of the particular problem I want to look at during this talk. You're given the finite simple graph. Okay, describe the graded Betti numbers of the corresponding edge ideal. Okay, and you want to determine if or how these numbers depend upon the combinatorial structure of the graph. Okay, and what we should notice is that we have an edge ideal, and that's a square-free monomial ideal. Okay, and there's been lots and lots of work done on the question of what is the resolution of a square-free monomial ideal. So one way to think about it is we're looking at kind of a sub problem in this much larger program. And the great thing is then we have a whole bunch of tools at our disposal in order to start tackling this particular question. Okay. One thing that we can do is we can restrict to the case of looking at the first. So you always start counting your R modules at 0, so 0, 1, 2. So you can ignore all the graded Betti numbers, beta 0j, because you actually construct the ideal from the graph, and that's calculating the number of generators of degree j. And you know that for each time you have an edge between a pair of vertices, you're getting a generator of degree 2. So there's this one-to-one correspondence between edges and in generators of degree 2, and that's it. So we can safely ignore this guy from the rest of the discussion. But it's kind of neat. Going back to our program, right, you're wondering how does the information from the graph show up in the graded Betti numbers? Well, here's just a simple one. The number of edges is coming from the first or the zeroth Betti number. Okay. So as I said, we were looking at kind of a class of square-free monomial ideals. So one of the best tools to start out with is kind of Hochster's formula. Okay. And Mel Hochster showed that the graded Betti numbers of a square-free monomial ideal can be described in terms of the reduced homology of a simplicial complex constructed from the generators of a monomial ideal. Okay. So basically what happens is you take a monomial ideal and you can make a simplicial complex from that ideal. And this is the usual Stanley-Reisner correspondence. Okay. And so what I have written up here is actually taking Hochster's formula and just specializing it to edge ideals. Okay, so when you take the edge ideal of the graph, okay, the ith graded Betti number now is summing over all subsets of the vertices. So let's read the pieces here. So you're taking all subsets of the vertices of size j. Okay, and what you're doing then is you're going to compute the dimension of the j minus I minus 2 reduced homology group of the simplicial complex here. Now, which simplicial complex are we looking at? Okay. It's pretty hard to kind of parse all this information. What you're doing is you're taking your graph G, and then you're taking the induced graph on that subset of vertices. So take your graph, take your subset of vertices, look at the graph just on those particular vertices, then take the complement of that graph, and then you're taking the clique complex of that graph. Okay, so for each subset, you're building a graph like this, and you're taking its clique complex. Okay, we won't be really using this too much from here, but I just wanted you to see this, that there is a formula, in some sense, for the ij squared of any numbers of the edge ideal of a graph.
Okay. You might think that if I have the central complex that corresponds to the monomial ideal of I,
yep. Right.
The edge ideal would be the outer dual.
No. So this is not a Stanley Reisner ideal, you're right, but when you think about it as a Stanley Reisner ideal, it's the Stanley Reisner ideal of the clique complex of the complement of this graph. Right, so the clique complex is, if the subset of vertices form a clique in the graph, then that becomes a face in your clique complex. Okay. So next slide here. Okay. So we do attain this formula, right, for all the graded Betty numbers, but this formula is difficult to apply. Okay. I mean, you're taking subsets of all vertices of a particular size, and then you have to form these induced graphs, its clique complements. Figure out its clique complex, and then you have to still go out and compute its reduced homology groups. Okay, so it's pretty bad, I think, and it gets us away from the goal too, right? We wanted to describe that information in terms of the graded, in terms of your graph G. Okay. One remark. Okay, let's go back here. Is remember I said you didn't really have to worry about K, but sometimes you do. Okay, and it's clear from this formula why you have to worry about the field K. Because if the characteristic isn't zero, sometimes this thing can be non-zero, but in characteristic zero, this thing could be zero. Okay, and it does happen. Okay, Katzmann found an example of a graph G on, I think it's 11 vertices, where the graded Betty numbers are different in characteristic 2 than characteristic 0. Okay, so unfortunately, this is kind of a puts a crimp into our program, right? Because what we want to do is just look at the graph G and say, okay, these are all the Betty numbers. Okay. Fortunately, we won't be able to always do that because the characteristic of K, you can't simply ignore the characteristic. Okay. But in special cases, you can still tease out kind of useful formulas for some of these graded Betty numbers. And this is some of the ideas behind the papers of Schatz and Katzmann, and myself and Mike Roth. Okay, so I just want to run through some consequences that you could get from using Hochster's formula and some other results. Okay, now, from the way I described it, it may not have been clear, but for each I, there's only going to be a finite number of J where the ij graded Betty numbers is going to be non-zero. So the first question is, okay, where can it be non-zero? Okay, and that's what the first lemma is saying, that if you fix an I, okay, and your graded Betty number is non-zero, then you know that J actually has to be between I plus 2 and bounded above by 2 times I plus 1. Okay. The lower bound is just coming from the fact that it's generated in degree 2. So this is just coming from the fact that you're talking about the linear strand. And the upper bound is coming from the Taylor complex, or the Taylor resolution of the edge ideal. And what's interesting is you can actually find formulas at the extremal values, okay, when J is either equal to I plus 2 or 2 times I plus 1. Okay, and how do those work? Okay, well, so the first formula right here is telling you what happens when J is as small as it can be. Okay, so when J is as small as it can be, the graded Betty number is now formed by summing over all subsets of the vertices of size I plus 2, and you're still taking that same kind of funny-looking graph. You're taking the induced graph on S, taking its complement, but now you don't have to worry about any reduced simplicial homology. You're just counting the number of components of that graph, and then you have to subtract off 1. Okay? So it's just information coming from your graph G. With enough patience, you could figure out this number just by looking at your graph G. And Katzmann had another result for kind of the upper bound at the other extremal value, And this number there is just going to be the number of induced subgraphs consisting of I plus one disjoint edges in your graph. Right. And so what we have here is that the extremal values actually don't depend upon K. And in Katzmann's result, I mean, it was somewhere actually in the middle of this range, I think, where things start going bad. Okay. And Katzmann actually proved something much stronger, that you actually had to go, I think, to the fourth or fifth step of the resolution before the characteristic is actually going to make a difference. Okay, so the beginning part of the resolution, the characteristic doesn't matter. So in that sense, we might be able to find formulas just coming from the graph for the graded Betti numbers.
Okay.
So it could be zero for, like, the linear strand could go zero, for example, for some point on, but there could be an I, right? It could be an I where I plus 2 is zero, but there could still be a J in this range where this thing is not zero.
So even the depth could depend on the length of the resolution.
No, I don't think the length of the resolution. Oh, maybe it could. Maybe it could. It's something to think about. Yeah, okay, that's a good question. I'll have to think about that. Yeah. Okay. Just kind of another result here, kind of in the same vein. What you're doing is actually you're massaging that formula I had on the slide for the linear strand a little bit more. And what you have here now is kind of a formula for any graph for, these are two numbers that are in the linear strand. And let me just walk you through it here. The graded Betti number beta 2, 4 is summing over all vertices of your graph, taking the degree of the vertex, choosing 3, and then you're subtracting off the number of cliques of size 4, but then you're adding back in the number of complete bipartite graphs of size 2, 2. Okay. And beta 3, 5 then is almost similar. You're taking all the vertices, taking the degree of the vertex, choose 4, binomial coefficient, subtract off the number of cliques of size 5, but then you're adding back in some information about the graph, the number of complete bipartite graphs of size 2, 3, the number of wheels, so this is the wheel W4 right here, of size 4, and then you have to look at how many induced subgraphs look like that guy right there. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, they're both positive. Oh, okay. So you would like get rid of that guy and rewrite it. Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. And a nicer way to look at it. Okay. No. These are induced subgraphs, right? So every K4 contains a K22. No, we're talking about induced subgraphs, though. So. Oh, did I say that? Right. So if you're taking the four vertices of the K4, it doesn't contain a K22. Right. Oh, okay. Okay, so let's see how to use this formula, going back to the same graph that I've been dragging along. Oops, and trying to get away again. beta 2, 4, right? We want to calculate this number. Now we can just look at the graph and use the information from the graph to calculate it. Okay, we're taking each of the degrees of each vertex, and we're choosing 3. So these guys all here have degree 2. So 2 choose 3 is just 0. This guy has degree 4. So it's 4 choose 3, that's where the 4 is coming for. It has no cliques of size 4, so it's got minus 0. But it does have one complete bipartite graph of size, or one complete bipartite graph of size 2, 2. Okay, so that's where the 1 is coming from. So we expect the Betti number beta 2, 4 to be 5, and we already saw that, because that's 0, 1, 2. How many times does minus 4 show up? It's the 5 right here. Okay, so the 5 and the 5, those are the two things that we're measuring here. Okay. Okay, now, we saw Hochster's formula, and it's kind of, unfortunately, really messy to work with. Okay, and it's really kind of hard to generalize from there. Okay. So, this is kind of getting to now kind of the new stuff that Ty and myself were working on. Okay? And kind of the starting point for our discussion was this new, it's not a new tool, it's been around for a while. It's the notion of a splittable monomial ideal. And it was invented by Ilio and Kaver in 1990. Okay, so just some terminology here. We'll let GI just denote the minimal generators of your monomial ideal. Okay, and we say that the monomial ideal is a splittable. It's splittable if you can actually break the ideal into two smaller ideals, J and K. So really, with the first condition just being that the generators of I are really just the disjoint generators of J and K. So really, you're looking at, you're laying out all the generators of I and just saying, okay, I'm going to slice it here. You guys get to be the generators of J, and you guys get to be the generators of K. Okay? But what you want to do is you want to make this division in the proper in a particular way. And you want to make it so that the generators of this ideal J intersect K satisfy a splitting function. So there's a map into the generators of J and a map into the generators of K, such that each time you take a generator of J intersect K, W is actually the least common multiple of the image under the first map and the image on the second map. And secondly, anytime you take a subset subset of generators of J intersect K, and if you look at that image of that subset under the first map and take the least common multiple of that image, it has to strictly divide the least common multiple of the set we start with, and similarly for the second map. You take S, you take everything in S and you map it into the generators of K. Okay, you take the least common multiple of that set, and that thing has to strictly divide the least common multiple of the set you divide with. Okay? Now, these are technical conditions, okay, and we won't see them at all anymore through the rest of the talk. But, an example of a splitting function, or of the splitting? Okay, well, that's kind of be the next slide, okay? And it's actually kind of the theme for the rest of the talk. Okay, so let me first explain why splittings are important, okay, in terms of gradient numbers, and then kind of get back to your question. So if an ideal is a splittable ideal, we'll just say it's a splitting. Okay, if you can find these two ideals, J and K, that form a splitting. Okay? Now, why are they interesting? It's because there's a nice relationship between the graded Betty numbers of the ideal I and the ideals J and K in which you split it into. Okay. So the graded Betty numbers of I is the graded Betty numbers of J plus the graded Betty numbers of K, plus, you have to do some appropriate shifting here, looking at a different part of the resolution, of the graded Betty numbers of J intersect K. Okay. So this kind of, once you know you have this tool out there, kind of leads to kind of a natural question is, well, you have an edge ideal. Okay. It's a monomial ideal. Can you split it so that you can get ideals J and K, so that J and K are actually edge ideals themselves, and J intersect K is also an edge ideal. Okay? And then you're going to go out and say, okay, I'm going to apply this formula, and you're going to get a recursive-like formula for the ij graded Betty numbers of your edge ideal. Well, if you split it, right, okay, that it might not have the second condition, right? Go back. Yeah, okay, the corresponding graphs, but you also want to make sure you know some information about J intersect K. And right, so if you're taking the two... No, it usually won't. It'll be like degree 3 or higher, okay? Because it's formed from the least common multiples of each of the generators. Right, so this may not be automatically... the edge ideal of a particular graph, but you have to kind of work out a way at it, and kind of out will pop such an ideal. Okay. So I'm kind of avoiding your question here. You did want to see an example, and I thought it was the next slide, but I actually have to go one more slide. Okay. So if we go back to the question, right, it's like what you want to do is how do you divide the edge ideal, right? Well, there's actually kind of two natural operations you'd want to be able to do it on anyway. Right, there's the idea of like removing an edge from a graph. Okay, that's one subgraph you could look at. Well, what are you doing in that case? If you take an edge uv in your graph, right, then it corresponds to the generator u times v. So you might as well just take that edge, put it off to one side, okay, and take the rest of the generators. And what's left over is the graph G minus that particular edge. Okay, so what we have is this thing right here. You might as well let those be J and K. And what about a vertex? It's the same thing. Let's take a vertex and pop it out of our graph, right? Well, a vertex has a whole bunch of neighbors, right? Let's say they're V1 through VD. So why don't you separate your generators to be all the generators that contain V on one side, everything else. And everything else will be the graph G with the vertex V removed. Okay? Now, all we've done, right, is split the generators. Okay? That doesn't necessarily make it a splitting because you have to satisfy a second condition. So let's give them names if they do have that property. So an edge is called a splitting edge of the graph if that particular edge will give you a splitting of your monomial ideal. Same thing with your vertex. It's a splitting vertex if you're getting a splitting of the edge ideal. Okay? So it's great. We have names for these things. But now we have to go out and make sure that they exist. Okay? And better yet, let's go out and characterize what is a splitting edge of a graph and what is a splitting vertex of a graph. Okay? So that's kind of where we were starting here. So if we take an edge of our graph, it's going to be a splitting edge if and only if all the neighbors of U are contained in the neighbors of V, or V itself, or all the neighbors of V are contained in the neighbors of U and U itself. Okay, so I have an example here. Okay, X4, X5 is not going to be a splitting edge. Okay, why is that? Well, X3 is a neighbor of X4, but it's not contained in the neighbor set of X5 or X5 itself. Okay, and vice versa, X6 is a neighbor of X5, but X6 is not a neighbor of X4. It's these guys, and it's not X4 itself. So this guy is not a splitting edge of our graph. On the other hand, which edge is? X2, X6. X2, X6 is a splitting edge because the neighbors of X6 are these two guys right here, and they are contained in all the neighbors of X2, which are these guys, and X2 itself. So this is an example of a splitting edge. Okay? And one of the consequences is any leaf is automatically a splitting edge of a graph. A leaf? These guys here. It's just a vertex of degree 1. Right. Okay. X5, X6? Yeah, it looks like it. Yep. So it's just looking at kind of the neighbors of it. Okay. So once you have your splitting of your graph, then you can go back and use that formula, Eliel and Cavert and Fatabi. But then you have to kind of massage it a little bit, right, to get out the proper result. Now, again, what graph are we looking at? Okay, so you take out a splitting edge. Okay, and it may look a little complicated at first glance here. H is now the graph that you get by taking your original graph, taking all the neighbors of U out and all the neighbors of V out. Okay, so that's a particular subgraph. Okay, and if we let M be the numbers of neighbors of U plus the numbers of neighbors of U and the numbers of neighbors of V, distinct neighbors, then the ijth graded Betti numbers is coming from the ijth graded Betti numbers of the graph G with the edge removed. And then this formula here, which is coming from a whole bunch of graded Betti numbers from this particular edge ideal right there. So H is that graph that you get by removing the neighbors of U and the neighbors of V. And this is just kind of little accounting work to keep things working out okay. Okay. No, there might not be a splitting edge. Okay. We're getting to the splitting vertex in a second. I'm trying to think of an example right off the top of my head without a cycle has one, yeah, and has no splitting edges except if it's C3. Okay. So a cycle has no splitting edges. Okay. Now it may look kind of messy at first glance, but what's kind of nice is that it actually allows us to recover almost most of the results in the literature about the graded Betti numbers of a tree. Okay. And why is that? Well, remember on the previous slide that I said that a leaf was a splitting edge? So whenever we get a tree, whenever you remove stuff, right, you're still ending up with a tree, so it always has a leaf. So this formula actually becomes recursive. Okay. In the case of the Betti, for the Betti numbers of edge ideals of trees. Okay. So, let me back up. So it's not recursive in general because, as Sarah just asked, there may be things that don't have any more splitting edges, so you can actually get stuck after a while. Okay, you can't keep repeating this process. But in the case of a tree, you can. And this was first proved by Schock and Katzman, but now it's just it's a corollary of the previous result that I had up there. Okay. The other thing that we can prove is a result of Zhang is we first have to introduce a definition here. We say that two edges are disconnected if the two edges don't share a common vertex, and there's a collection of edges that are also aren't in the graph G. So there's no edge between U1 and U2, U1 and V2, V1 and U2, and V1 and V2. And Zhang was able to prove that if you're now just taking the edge ideal of a forest, then the regularity of that ideal, and the regularity is just another invariant relating to the resolution, is just counting the number of maximal number of pairwise disconnected edges in your forest. Okay. And again, you can just recover it from the previous formula. And it becomes actually a combinatorial type of argument. Okay. So going to the splitting vertexes, okay, so we kind of have a nice complete story about when is an edge going to be a splitting edge. What about a splitting vertex? Well, actually, there are a lot more of these. Okay, almost every vertex is going to be a splitting vertex. It's a splitting vertex if and only if the degree of the vertex is bigger than zero, and when you remove that vertex, you're not getting isolated vertices. Okay, so the only thing that can go bad if you try to take this as your splitting vertex, because when you remove that, you're getting isolated vertices. So in this graph here, every vertex is a splitting vertex. Okay. So you get a whole bunch of them. Okay, but you pay for it. Okay, I mean, you may get a whole bunch of splitting vertices, but now you're going to pay for it in your formula. Okay, the formula has become more complicated. So there's a lot of information here too on this graph. So you're taking your splitting vertex. Okay, and you're taking all the neighbors of that guy. Okay. Then we take a new graph in GV, and that's going to be the graph by the induced graph on the neighbors of V, okay, and any edge that's incident to V1 through VD. Okay, so here's an example. I'm going to take V as my splitting vertex. Its neighbors are V1 and V2. Okay. So GV in parentheses here is going to be the graph V1 and V2, the neighbors of V1, and the neighbors of V, the induced graph on that, and anything that's incident to those guys in the original graph. That's G sub V. And GI is going to be the graph that you get by taking out all the neighbors of V and all the neighbors of VI. Okay? And this is the formula that Ty and I found then, relating the graded bedding numbers of the original edge ideal to smaller ones. So the graded bedding number of IJ, of the edge ideal, is coming from the graded bedding numbers of the complete bipartite graph K1D. And that's easy to figure out, that's fine. The graded bedding numbers of the graph G with the vertex V removed. And then this ideal L, okay, and this is where the problems start coming in. L is not going to be the edge ideal of a graph, but it's going to be made from a collection of edge ideals. And which collection? Well, it's going to be made from the edge ideal of this graph, plus the edge ideal of the graph G1, which is the graph with all the vertices of V removed, and all the neighbors of all the vertices, in all the neighbors of V1 removed, and so on. So it's made from a whole collection of edge ideals. Okay, so we kind of pay for it. It's great we get a whole bunch more splitting vertices, but the formula becomes messy. Okay, in splitting edges, there aren't that many, but and the benefit was we got a nicer formula. That's going to be kind of what we headed to next. If you pick things to be nice, okay, then you can actually still kind of extract out more things here. You know, oh man, I'm having trouble here today. Okay. So let's look at some consequences. Okay. I already mentioned the linear strand. Okay. These are kind of the smallest the bedding numbers can be for each I. You can actually now go back to the previous formula and still get a recursive formula for the graded bedding numbers in the linear strand. Okay. So you ignore all the other graded bedding numbers, but just interested in the smallest that it can be. You're getting a recursive formula. And it's just coming from the complete bipartite graph K1D, the graph G minus V, and that funny graph G, kind of looking at the neighbors of V, and so on. And you have to play with the shifts a little bit. Okay? You may have noticed I had to play with that. And there's a reason for that. It's okay. And so just a definition here. So we say that a cycle of length at least 4 that contains no chord is a minimal cycle. Okay, so the triangle is not considered a minimal cycle. And So one of the things you can actually now reprove using this corollary, is something that I did with Mike, is that if you take a simple graph and you assume, you make an assumption that your graph has no minimal cycles of length 4. Okay, so nowhere in your graph are you going to have an induced thing that looks like this. Then there's a nice formula for the graded Betty numbers in the linear strand. You're summing over all vertices and taking their degrees, choosing I plus 1, and subtracting off the number of cliques of size I plus 2. Okay, so you're just making one assumption that there's no induced graphs that are isomorphic to the cycle. Okay, now look at the nice thing is if you now assume that your graph is a forest, right, it has no cliques, so all you're getting is that particular formula right here. You're just getting a formula directly in terms of the degrees of the vertices. Okay. Another term here, definition, it's kind of an algebraic definition. We say that an ideal I satisfies property N2P if I is generated in quadratics and the first P steps of the resolution are linear. Okay, so that just means when you're looking at the resolution, there's only going to be, it's going to begin to look like R shifted by minus 2 and no other stuff. And then it's going to have R shifted by minus 3 and no other shifts. Okay, and it's going to happen up to the P step. And then when you get to the P plus 1 step, you're going to have some other shifts showing up. Okay. Now, I guess it was last year, or maybe the year before already, Eisenbug, Green, and Hewlett, and Popescu was able to classify the when an edge ideal, okay, will have property N2P. Okay. And one of the corollaries of the result that Ty and I just had up on the previous slide is you can actually reprove this result using kind of combinatorial means by looking at the particular graph and its subgraphs. So what is this result? Well, if you take a simple graph and you take its edge ideal, then this ideal will satisfy property N2P for some P bigger than 1 if and only if you look in the complement, every minimal cycle has a particular length. Okay? So this is really interesting because you can say how long your resolution is going to be linear by looking at its complement and reading off how big a cycle shows up. Okay? And it becomes a corollary of that the splitting vertex formula that I had. Okay? And Froberg, well, actually this is an old result of Froberg, early 90s, maybe it's even later. And it's actually a corollary of Eisenbug's and everybody else's result, is that you actually know when the ideal has a linear resolution. So that just means that the resolution looks like shifted by minus 2, minus 3, and so on. And that only happens if the complement to the graph is a chordal graph. Okay, so that means it has every minimal cycle has a chord. Yeah. 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 Mhm. Okay. So I've really been concentrating on edge ideals. Okay. So let's go beyond edge ideals. Okay. I said one of the problems with the Hochstra formula was it's kind of hard to push things. Okay. Because things get kind of messy. And what can this notion of a splittable ideal, which has proved very profitable to study edge ideals, can you do it to study much more general square Feenmanomials ideals in general? So just a quick definition here. A simplicial complex delta on a set of vertices x1 through xn is a collection of subsets of V such that each of the singleton sets xi belongs to simplicial complex. And every time you have a subset belonging to the simplicial complex, each of its subsets also belong to it. And then the maximal elements of this set under inclusion are called the facets of the simplicial complex. So what you can do is you can associate to a simplicial complex what's called a facet ideal. Okay? And how does it work? Well, you take all the facets of your simplicial complex, and for each element in your facet, okay, you just take the product of those things. Okay? So this is not the Stanley-Reisner correspondence. Okay, it's kind of almost the exact opposite. Because in the Stanley-Reisner correspondence, you're looking at the non-faces, and here you're using the maximal faces to build your edge ideal. Okay. So just a quick example. We have a vertex set on four vertices, and our simplicial complex, I've drawn it this way, is x1, x2, x3. Shaded in means that we have the set x1, x2, x3 in our simplicial complex. And because of the second condition, that means x1, x2 has to be in there, x2, x3, x1, x3. And I have this other guy here, x3, x4 in there. Okay, and then you have all the vertices. So the maximal, or the facet then, is this face right here, which is where you're getting x1, x2, x3, and then x3, x4, which is giving you the other facet. Okay, so the notion of a facet ideal, which you can see generalizes the notion of an edge ideal, right? By taking the edges, okay, you're making the generators here, you're taking the facets, making the generators. This is introduced by Sarah. Okay? And one of the things that also that Sarah did was be very precise about what you mean by a leaf of a simplicial complex. Okay, once you have a notion of a leaf, then you can go off and describe what a simplicial tree is and a simplicial forest. Okay, so just run through the definition here. F is a facet of a simplicial complex, and it's a leaf. It's either the only facet, okay, or there exists a facet G in the simplicial complex different from F, such that whenever you take any other guy different from F and intersect F and F prime, it's going to be contained in F intersect G. Okay? So once you have a leaf, a simplicial tree is just a connected simplicial complex where every non-empty connected set has a leaf, and then a forest. Simplicial forest is when every connected component is a simplicial tree. Okay? You can do now the same trick. Okay, take a leaf inside of your simplicial complex. And let's go back to this notion of splittable ideal. The leaf corresponds to a generator in your facet ideal. So that's this guy right here. You take the leaf, and then you take the rest of your generators, and that's going to correspond to taking your simplicial complex and ignoring that one facet. Okay? And when you have a leaf, you're getting a splitting of your facet ideal. Okay? So using this fact, we can actually generalize Jackson-Katzmann results to the following, is that whenever you have a simplicial forest, okay, you don't just need a forest, you can do this in general for a simplicial forest, you get a recursive formula for the graded Betti numbers of the simplicial forest. Okay? So that was kind of the advantage of looking at the notion of a splittable ideal. Okay? So I'm going to end up here on my last slide. Okay? Just kind of give you some pointers about where to go to next and what I've been thinking about. Okay. I just on the previous slide I showed that a leaf allowed you to split the facet ideal. Okay, well, why don't we just say whenever you take a facet in your simplicial complex, we'll call it a splitting facet if this actually all gives you a splitting of your facet ideal. Okay, so it's just like generalizing a splitting edge. Okay, so in a current project, both with Tai Ha and Jessica Sidman, what we've been able to do is now classify when is a facet going to be a splitting facet of your simplicial complex. So really, you can kind of rephrase it without this notion of a simplicial complex. It's asking, whenever you have a square-free monomial ideal, what properties does a monomial have to have so that the monomial and the rest of the ideal is a splitting? Okay, you don't really have to use the language of the simplicial complexes. One of the things we've been thinking of is the first gives you a generalization of a splitting edge. What about a splitting vertex, okay, in the context of the simplicial complex? And so what we would like to do is find an analog of a splitting vertex. Okay, so we're kind of working hard on that. Okay, we're still not sure what form this analog should take. And just one other result that I wanted to mention is I put the slide up that Zhang showed that the regularity of the forest is related to the number of disconnected edges in a forest. So currently we have a partial generalization of this for a special class of simplicial forests. So for this class of simplicial forests, you define a notion of a disconnected facet. Okay, and it's just the regularity is the number of disconnected facets in your graph. Okay, so I think I'll end there and stop there. Going back to Froberg proved the result that if you want to study the graded Betti numbers of a monomial ideal, you can always just look at through polarization, look at a square-free monomial ideal. So, I mean, even if you do allow loops, right, you might as well just take the square-free after polarization. So that's why it's always been square-free. You can always, we're skipping a step, but yeah.
There are some results that turn side or somebody, I can't remember who, some of the Greater Bay Areans in a general monomial disorder do not depend on the test. He was also interested in a special what part of the resolution of independent diagnosis. And there were some theorems about certain Betty numbers not dependent on the test.
Right, I think you have to go up to the third or fourth one in general.
There is some result there.
Yeah. I mean, but if the resolution has length 6 or something, like it projected on certain, if the resolution has a certain length, okay, then the characteristic doesn't come into play at all. How did that work again? I can't remember, but there are results, I think. Oh, so you're going back to the question?
I want to get the end.
Okay.
I know they have results about the beginning. My recollection is that we stop at the beginning of the resolution. And the end is we're back to
sample. Yeah. As far as I know, it's not the end. Like, you're not adding like something else to the end of the resolution. Okay. As far as I know, it's like the resolution may have a particular length. Let's say length L. Okay. And there's another shift at the length L that shows up. It's not like there was nothing there, and then you're suddenly popping on a new shift. And as far as I haven't seen any examples or results like that. And so you're wondering now, like, yeah, does the projected dimension change, right, through characteristics?